going to plough on with a little history. Not at great length, but there's a purpose in it, and it'll soon be evident. Hymns do go back a long way. And in England, there were hymns, evidently, in Saxon times, among the so-called gleemen. And there were many before that Latin hymns, quite a good tradition of early Latin hymns. Many of them have been translated over the years. And while there are many Latin hymns that are tainted with the doctrines of Rome, there are others that have pure evangelical piety. As you know, a number of them survive in the books today. And in Saxon times, there were a number of Latin hymns that were written with Old English gloss between the lines, so they were translated, in other words, and used in that form. But the great time for hymns really came with the Reformation, and pretty soon after 1517, and through Luther particularly, hymns began to be produced, and almost his first was his hymn based on Psalm 46, a safe stronghold, our God is still, or a mighty fortress, if you have that translation familiar with them, to you. In fact, there were supposed to be several hundred translations of that hymn of Luther's. And it's amazing how quickly hymns were written. There was, within two or three years, a book of 35, 50 German hymns. And within a matter of 30, 40 years, there's a number estimated at 6,000 German hymns. So the Reformation certainly gave rise to huge numbers of hymns. And these German hymns were the best of them that we see. They had firm structure. They had good theme discipline. That is to say, the hymn writer's theme was continued from line to line. That's an essential part of a good hymn. And in our hymn tradition, that is true of most published hymns. They hold a good thread, a good theme. Why, I was looking the other day at some of these, it won't be true of all of them, but some leading contemporary hymns. And line one sets up a theme. Line two follows it. Line three is a rhyming line. So the theme is abandoned because the hymn writer can't think of a rhyme and keep his theme, so he abandons it. Line four is a rhyming line, so he has to abandon even the theme that he brought in when he abandoned his first two-line theme. And so it's so haphazard, higgledy-piggledy, and the last two lines don't match what he was setting out to do in the first two lines at all, and that seems to be common. There are some people who surmount that, and this is from some of these writers who are lauded and applauded and admired and highly paid for this, I'm sorry to say, junk, poetic junk. We sang a wonderful hymn of Wesley's just before I began to speak. He seems to effortlessly be able to produce hymns, often of six and eight lines, where the theme is utterly, ruggedly continuous and consistent, not only through the verse, but through the hymn. That's a gift, friend. That's ability. And nobody paid him for it. And the people who write the junk that you see in contemporary music today are highly paid. But you see, they've learned to put themselves across like theatrical people, and foolish people actually admire them. And they can't even do it when it comes to the lyrics. They can't hold a theme. They can't be consistent. And the themes they do have are so often shallow and sentimental more than significant. So I'm sorry to say all those things, but the quality, by and large, is incredibly poor. Anyway, back to my history. And the German hymns, did they come into Britain? Well, not at that time, because the Puritans were very resistant to hymns. And it was a great virtue of the Puritans that, oh, there were exceptions, usually among the Royalists, but there were exceptions among the Puritans. So we have hymns from Richard Baxton, we have hymns from Samuel Crossman, and quite a few others. Beautiful hymns. But by and large, the Puritans resisted hymns because they weren't scripture. And one of the great strengths of the Puritan age was everything must flow from scripture. So that's good. But it did mean that they didn't care for hymns. And so only in time do hymns emerge. There are hymn books, at least there are psalm paraphrases that have an appendix where discreetly some hymns are parked. There's Coverdale's wonderfully named Goosley Psalms and Spiritual Songs, 1539. And that has 15 of Luther's hymns in it, but it's mainly psalm paraphrases. And then Sternhold and Hopkins' famous Psalter, also from the mid-16th century. That has an appendix with some hymns. And one of the first producers of hymns in the later Puritan period was John Mason. We have some of his hymns surviving to this day, but they're very rugged hymns. He was a scholar and a gentleman, but he wrote particularly for his rustic community that he served as a clergyman. And the first true hymn book, I suppose, is held to be 1623, a famous book compiled by a man named George Withers. But then, as you get to the end, and you'll see why I'm telling you this history in a moment, as you get towards the end of the 17th century, there is a great breakthrough in hymns. Matthew Henry had a book of hymns, but they weren't designed for public worship, they were for family worship. And among Baptists and Independents, the main reason why hymns never took root for a period was persecution. Until 1688 and the Toleration Act, of course, you met in secret. You didn't want to sing. It would give away the fact that there was worship involved. This church, in those days, under the ministry of Benjamin Keach, who was the second pastor of the church, and at one occasion, they had a house not far from here, two houses together. And at the party wall, at the landing level, there was a hole made in the wall and a kind of a hatch put there. And Benjamin Keach, or whoever was preaching for him, would be in one house. And in the other house, half the landing was removed and walls taken down so that the people standing, there was not enough room to sit, there were too big a crowd, they would all stand downstairs and in all what was supposed to be the bedrooms upstairs, and the floors would sag, we read, because a lot of the walls had been taken away, and the preacher would address them from the next door house through the party wall, and they would all listen. And the reason for that is when the constables came and they broke in through the door, the preacher would simply close the hatch, and he was in another house. And the law expressly said he must be in the same house. So that's what they did for some years to avoid the arrest of the preacher. But nevertheless, Benjamin Keach was constantly being arrested and put in the stocks and fined all his goods and possessions. But he kept on. And then it wasn't until the 1670s that they could begin to start to introduce hymns, because the persecution became a little less severe. And because this, the tabernacle, we started singing among the nonconformists, we like to say. In 1673, Benjamin Keach introduced hymn singing to the tabernacle congregation. Never before, because it would have betrayed the fact that an illegal meeting was being carried on. And because there were aging saints there who had never sung and were deeply suspicious of this innovation, he adopted the practice of introducing one hymn after the benediction of the service. And gradually the congregation got used to it. I must say his hymns weren't very good by modern judgment, but anyway, he compiled a book called Christian Melody with 300 hymns in it. The Independents also, the group that became known as the Congregationalists in due time, they started to sing hymns roughly about the same time. We were first, I think, but they started about the same time. And the reason I'm saying this is that that was really the beginning of the present hymn tradition. And hymns came in very quickly, and very fine hymns. Of course, the first very well-known hymn writer of substance was Isaac Watts, who produced his first hymns at about that time. He was born in 1679. He started writing hymns at the age of 20, and 1674, I beg your pardon. And in 1694, he began to write hymns, and in 2 years, between the ages of 20 and 22, he had written the bulk of his hymns. That is so humbling and astonishing when you think of the theological depth of his hymns. It is amazing he wrote them as a youngster. He'd always been a suffering person, even in his youth. He was sick all his life. He suffered, it sounds suspiciously like, some kind of rheumatic heart disease. And he was always disabled and in difficulty and puffing and panting. And maybe through his suffering came so much of his understanding and his sympathy and his tenderness for hymns. But his hymns began to be published, and they were characterized by simplicity and yet depth. You know what we say about the parables of the Lord? How simple they are, and yet how profound. Well, of course, I'm not suggesting Watts's hymns are in the same league, but they're in a similar sort of pattern. They are so simple, and yet they are so profound and so searching and so wonderful. And they honour all the elements of worship. They're all in his hymns. And he Christianised the Psalms. And there's such doctrinal richness by Christianising the Psalms. That means to say, very simply, that where the psalmist David or others spoke about their literal, physical, human enemies on earth, he turns those statements into statements about our spiritual enemies, the world, the flesh, and the devil, to make them, those psalms, spiritually useful to us. That's what he does constantly. He puts the Christian sense upon the psalms. I got a little example here. I think I quoted this hymn last year in an entirely different connection. But to me, it's just one example will be sufficient. Let me read the verses of Psalm 13 and just look at the paraphrase of Watts, and you'll see what I mean. Here it is. How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord, forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long shall mine enemy be exalted over me? Consider and hear me, O Lord my God. Lighten mine eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death, lest mine enemy say, I have prevailed against him, and those that trouble me rejoice when I am moved. But I have trusted in thy mercy. My heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. I will sing unto the Lord, because he hath dealt bountifully with me. Now, all the psalm paraphrases in the metrical psalters are very nice on that. But listen to Watts. How long wilt thou conceal thy face? My God, how long delay? When shall I feel those heavenly rays that chase my fears away? It's the inner battle he's got in mind. See how the prince of darkness tries all his malicious arts. He spreads a mist around my eyes and throws his fiery darts. How would the tempter boast aloud if I became his prey? And how the sons of earth grow proud at thy so long delay? And then this famous, famous verse, which for some extraordinary reason isn't in most of the hymn books today, and our forebears used to love it and use it devotionally. But hell shall fly at thy rebuke, and Satan hide his head, He knows the terrors of thy look and hears thy voice with dread. Thou wilt display that sovereign grace where all my hopes have hung. I shall employ my heart in praise, and victory shall be sung. That's wonderful, Watts, encapsulating the spiritual battle and giving us something to hold on to and drawing the great value from the psalm. But there's so much doctrinal richness in Watts. Not so many years ago, the British Museum had a most fascinating exhibition in one of its departments of old English samplers. By samplers, we mean pieces of embroidery, either done as tray coverings or to decorate home and so on. And there were many samplers, pieces of embroidery, small pieces by little children in from village schools. Somehow they'd been recovered. Aged 8, 9, 10, ages like that. And the children evidently in different schools were told, you can embroider anything you like, a message to your mother, your father, or anything. And the amazing thing was how many children decided to embroider their favourite hymn verse. And it would invariably be a verse of Watts. All those children in the village schools, all with a very clear idea in their mind about the theology that Watts taught in his hymns. These are wonderful verses. They can be understood by anyone. And experts have pointed out that Watts used a limited vocabulary deliberately, but often he introduces new words to the public vocabulary. And he was so clever that he could do it in such a way that no dictionary was required. It was obvious what that word meant when you came to it. He was almost engaged in public education as well as the writing of hymns. The man had such an extraordinary gift. The Christology of the hymns is wonderful. The grammar in the hymns is perfect. The grammar in the hymns of most contemporary things that I've seen is awful. The grammar in the hymns was faultless. The objective, subjective categories of worship were honoured. It's often been pointed out that each line in a Watts hymn is complete. The theme continues, but each line is self-contained and complete. That may be because there were so many illiterate people, and in many simple churches, the hymns were given out line by line. But it's extraordinary the number of things he had to honour in the writing of a hymn. Each hymn has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that can't be said for many modern contrivances either. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, magnificent hymns. Why do people want to throw them out? What possesses people? They're much more understandable than modern productions. I'm not against modern productions if they're in the genre, the traditional reverent genre that we're used to. That's wonderful. Find me people who can write them and match the standards that we're used to. But today it's all dumbed down, and we get puerile lines, and we get carnal style singing, and bad rhymes, and jumping scents, and sloppy grammar. Oh, friends, and I'm talking about the words, and the music is disqualified, however brilliant, for 101 other reasons. But when you think of the sloppy things that pass for sacred verse today, I think it's true what one wise man said: when the devil pulls down God's people, he loves to make fools of them in the process. To think there are congregations everywhere, forgive the term, singing junk. That's what it amounts to. It's tragic, friends. Why ever do people want to do that? And I haven't mentioned Doddridge, and I'll be shot by Brother Roland Burroughs because I haven't mentioned Wesley. What a marvellous, marvellous hymn writer. What standards? What accomplished verse? What well-developed themes? What biblical sentiments captured? And Newton and Montgomery, and dear old Joseph Hart, so rugged, but yet so wonderful, so many of his verses. No one can do that today. I shouldn't say that. Some people probably can, and we would welcome it. It's all famous names and lots of money today, not matched by any ability or any grammar or any depth or anything of that kind. But what I really wanted to say, and I'll move to conclusion with this, is that the late 1990s marked a great celebration which nobody celebrated. 300 years of the traditional Protestant hymn genre in England. Longer if you count Germany and other places, much longer if you go back to the Gleeman, but I'm not wanting to do that. 300 years of wonderful productions and magnificent development. Wonderful, wonderful praise and worship in our body of hymnody. Perfected. Perhaps I ought not to use that word. So developed, loved, powerful, unmatched, convicting, convincing, humbling, uplifting, comforting, teaching, commanding respect from all kinds of people, reverent, sacred, sacred in terms of being distinct from anything the world produces. Wonderful to have a whole corpus of wonderful tunes that are distinct from anything the world does. And verse, lyrics so rich and so full. Remember the philosophy, friends. I'm going to conclude. Defend this God-given heritage of hymns for worship, and always remember the vital elements of worship, and that you can't possibly say, when the devil does something good or passable, we will use it. You can't reason like that. May God help us and bless us and use us and keep us loyal to the great things that he's given to us.